Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we are putting away the pristine, idealized textbooks, you know, the ones that describe how the world should work. And we are finally dealing with the world as it actually is.
It is a necessary transition, isn't it? I mean, you can't stay in the sandbox forever. Eventually, you have to go out into the field.
Exactly. We are leaving the theoretical classroom behind and stepping out into the, well, the messy, chaotic, noisy reality of actual economic data.
It's where the fun starts, I think.
I agree. So today we're diving deep into analysis of economics data, specifically Chapter 12, which is titled Further Topics and Multiple Regression by A. Colin Cameron.
And I want to be very clear right from the top about our target audience for this. If you are a first-year economics student and you're maybe sweating over your econometrics term paper right now.
I've been there.
We all have. Or, you know, if you're just someone trying to figure out why your regression output looks a bit suspicious, this deep dive is explicitly designed as a study guide for you.
We're treating this as the bridge, really. You spend the first half of the semester learning the theory, what I like to call OLS Utopia.
Right.
In OLS Utopia, ordinary least squares works perfectly. The error terms are these polite, well-behaved little numbers that don't talk to each other and, crucially, all have the exact same variance.
But Chapter 12 basically opens the door and says, surprise, real data is not like that. I mean, in almost every real-world application, assumptions 3 and 4 of the classical regression model.
It's homoscedasticity and independence of errors.
Exactly. Those two are just too restrictive. They almost never hold up in the wild.
So let's set the stage by defining the core problem here. We had these assumptions. When they fail, what actually happens? If I run a regression and my data violates these assumptions, is my model? Is it just garbage?
That is the most common fear students have. They see that failed diagnostic test and they think, oh no, my data is heteroscedastic, my entire research is invalid.
Right. Panic sets in.
The answer is a resounding no. Your model is not garbage. Even if those assumptions fail, your OLS estimates, I mean the actual coefficients, the Bayesian data values, are still unbiased.
Let's clarify that, because that's a huge point. So if my regression finds that one extra year of education increases earnings by, say, $5,000, that number, the $5,000, is still my best guess.
Correct. It is still the unbiased point estimate. On average, you're pointing in the right direction. However, and this is the critical however, the default standard errors are wrong.
Okay, so the direction is right, but my speedometers is broken.
That is a perfect analogy. The coefficients are right, but our ruler for measuring our certainty about those coefficients is completely broken. And this triggers a domino effect that you absolutely need to understand for your exams.
Okay, walk us through the dominoes. Where does it start?
Domino one, the standard errors are wrong. That's the first one to fall.
Right.
Domino two, because the t-statistic is calculated by dividing the coefficient by the standard error. Well, if the denominator is wrong, the t-statistics are also wrong.
Makes sense.
Domino three. If the t-statistics are wrong, then the confidence intervals you build around your coefficients are wrong.
And the final domino.
The final domino, the one that really matters for your paper's conclusion, is that your hypothesis tests are wrong.
Which means I might think a variable is statistically significant when it absolutely isn't.
Or, just as bad, you might miss a real effect. You might conclude a policy has no impact because your standard errors were artificially inflated and your t-stat was too small.
You could literally publish a paper claiming a policy works when it doesn't just because you didn't account for the error structure.
It happens. So the mission of this session is twofold. First, we need to explain how to fix inference using what we call robust standard errors. And then we're going to pivot to a really crucial distinction in prediction. The difference between predicting an average versus predicting an individual outcome.
Okay, let's start with the fix. Section one, inference with robust standard errors. Robust is a strong word. What does it actually mean in the statistical context?
In statistics, robust generally means that the method works well even if the underlying assumptions are a bit off. Or, you know, more than a bit off.
So it's forgiving.
It's forgiving. Specifically, we're relaxing assumptions 3 and 4. We're acknowledging that the errors might have different variances or they might be correlated with each other. We're letting the data be messy.
And to reiterate what you said earlier, the golden rule of this chapter, we change the standard errors, but we do not touch the coefficients.
That is correct. It's so important. I think it's worth saying again, the coefficients, denoted as BJ dollars, remain identical. We are only changing the standard error, which we'll denote as Rober.
So what are the monsters we're fighting here? What makes the data non-robust to begin with? The text outlines three main complications.
Yes, the three main complications that require robust standard errors are 1, heteroscedasticity.
Okay.
2, clustered errors.
Right.
And 3, autocorrelation.
Let's take them one by one, nice and slow. First up, heteroscedasticity.
This is arguably the most common issue you'll find in cross-sectional data. Technically, it means the variance of the error term depends on the observations. The errors are not constant.
I always visualize this as the trumpet shape in a scatter plot, or maybe a megaphone.
Exactly. That's the classic textbook image. Imagine plotting income on the x-axis and, say, spending on food on the y-axis.
Okay.
For low-income families, the budget is really tight. They have to spend a very specific, predictable amount on food. The data points are all clustered tightly around the regression line.
There's not a lot of variation.
Very little. But for billionaires,
all bets are off.
A billionaire might spend $500 on food one week and $50,000 the next because they threw a massive banquet. The variance is huge. So as you move to the right on the x-axis, the spread of the data explodes. That is heteroscedasticity.
Got it. Okay, complication number two, clustered errors.
This one happens when errors in the same group or cluster are correlated. Think about students in the same classroom.
They all share the same teacher, the same lighting in the room, the same fire alarm that goes off randomly.
Right. All of those shared environmental factors. So their test scores, and more importantly, the errors in predicting those scores, are not truly independent. If the teacher is having a particularly good day and explains a concept brilliantly, everyone's score might bump up together.
And if the teacher's having a bad day?
Everyone might dip together. The errors move in sympathy with each other within that classroom.
Okay. And the third complication?
Autocorrelation. This is the big one for time series data. It's when errors are correlated over time. The error from yesterday's observation has a relationship with today's.
Like if GDP growth is unexpectedly high this quarter, it's pretty likely to be unexpectedly high next quarter too. There's some momentum.
Exactly. The error lingers or has a memory. It doesn't just reset to zero with each new observation.
So we have these three problems. How do we actually implement the fix? For the students listening who have to do this in Statter or R, is this a nightmare of manual calculation?
Thankfully, no. In the, you know, the 1970s, it would have been. But in the modern era, implementation is handled entirely by statistical packages. It's become incredibly easy.
Okay, let's get the specific commands then for the listeners.
Please. If you are using Stata, which is very common in economics programs, you simply use the regress command as you normally would.
So regress y of 1 by 2.
And then you add a comma and the option V robust.
That's it. Just VC robust.
That is it. VCE stands for variance covariance estimate. You're telling Stata, hey, don't assume the variance is constant. Calculate the standard errors using the robust estimator.
Wow. Okay, and for the R users?
In R, it's typically a two-step process, usually involving a package called sandwich.
The sandwich package.
You run your linear model with the ELM function as usual. Then you use a function like VCOVHC from the sandwich package to get the robust covariance matrix, and you feed that into your summary tools.
Why do they call it the sandwich package? I've always wondered that.
It's a visual metaphor for the matrix algebra behind the scenes. The formula for the robust variance estimator involves three matrices multiplied together.
Okay.
The outer two matrices are identical, that's the bread, and the middle one, which contains the squared residuals, is the meat, hence the sandwich estimator.
Economists and their food metaphors. Okay, so once the computer spits out this new robust standard error, how does the math proceed? Does anything else change?
Nope. You proceed exactly as you did in the first half of the semester. You calculate the t-statistic using the new, more trustworthy standard error. The formula is still t beta shi beta sha.
So the numerator is the same, the coefficient minus the hypothesized value, but the denominator, the standard error, is different.
Correct. And for your confidence intervals, you use the standard formula you've already memorized. BJP, critical time, C Robichair. The logic of inference hasn't changed at all. Only the precision of the ruler you're using has been corrected.
That makes it much less intimidating. Okay, let's do a deep dive into that first monster you mentioned, heteroscedasticity. This is section 2 of our outline. You defined it as the variance depending on the x's.
Yes. And let's get formal for a moment, because this is what you'd write on an exam. We are replacing assumption 3, which says varui equals sigma 2, a constant, with assumption $3, which says varui equals sigma 2.
Notice the subscript on the sigma.
That's the whole story. Every single observation potentially has its own variance.
Which sounds completely chaotic.
Yeah.
If every observation has its own unique variance, how can we possibly find a pattern? How do we estimate anything?
That is where the genius of the robust method comes in. It's often called the White Estimator or the Eicher-Huber-White Estimator to give everyone credit. It doesn't require you to know the form of the heteroscedasticity.
What does it do instead?
It uses the squared residuals from the OLS regression itself as a proxy, as an estimate for this unknown variance structure. It lets the data tell you how the variance is behaving.
Okay, let's make this concrete with the case study from the source material. We have a house price example.
This is a great little data set for understanding the mechanics. We have a small sample, just $100 and $209 a lawn. We're regressing house price on several variables: size, lot size, bedrooms, bathrooms, year built, and age, a pretty standard model.
So we run the regression. First, let's look at the coefficients. The coefficient for size is 68.37.
Right, so the interpretation is that for every additional square foot of floor space, the price of the house is predicted to increase by roughly $68.37, holding all the other variables constant.
And as we established, this number, 68.37, is the same whether we use the default standard errors or the robust ones. The point estimate is stable.
Correct. But now look at the standard errors. The text provides a table comparing the default versus robust SEs. In this specific data set, the robust standard error for size is 15.36.
Okay, so if we calculate the t-statistic, that would be 68.37 divided by 15.36.
We get a t-statistic of 4.44. Now, with 29 observations, your degrees of freedom is pretty low, but a t-sat of 4.44 is huge. The p-value is 0.000, so size is statistically significant at the 5% level, the 1% level, really any level you care about.
But what about the other variables? This is where the results get a little weird and maybe confusing for a student.
It is very weird. Even with the robust standard errors, the t-statistics for lot size, bedrooms, bathrooms, year built, and age are all very low. For instance, the t-stat for lot size is only 0.43.
That seems to imply that the size of the yard doesn't matter for the price of a house, which is just intuitively wrong.
And this is exactly where students often get tripped up. They look at the individual t-stats and say, oh, only size matters, nothing else matters, I should drop all these other variables.
But you shouldn't do that.
You should not. You have to test them as a group.
The F-test for joint significance.
Exactly. We need to test the null hypothesis that all the slope coefficients are simultaneously equal to zero. When you do that, the F-statistic in this case is 6.41 with a p-value of 0.0005.
So we strongly reject the null. The variables as a group are definitely explaining the price. There's explanatory power here.
Yes. It's a classic symptom of what we call multicollinearity. Size, number of bedrooms, and number of bathrooms are all highly correlated with each other. Big houses have more bedrooms and bathrooms.
So they're all sort of measuring the same underlying concept of bigness.
And they're fighting for the credit of explaining the variance in price. Individually, they look weak, but together they are strong.
The text mentions a subset test as well. This was interesting. They took it one step further.
Right. They tested the joint significance of everything except for size. So they tested the null that the coefficients on lot size, bedrooms, bathrooms, and so on were all jointly zero.
And what did they find?
The p-value for that subset test was 0.8038.
That is huge. So we failed to reject the null.
We failed to reject it spectacularly. Basically, for this specific small sample of 29 houses, once you account for the square footage, the size, the other variables don't add enough unique, statistically significant information to distinguish their effects from zero.
That is a really powerful insight. And the key takeaway here is that using the robust standard errors gives us the license to trust these conclusions. We know we aren't being misled by a faulty assumption about the variance of house prices.
Precisely. Heteroscedastic robust errors are the standard fix, the default tool, when you suspect your errors are independent, but their variances differ.
Okay, let's move to section three. Clustered and autocorrelated errors. You mentioned the village analogy earlier. Let's expand on that because this is a concept that shows up constantly in development economics, labor economics, and policy analysis.
It's huge. So cluster robust standard errors address the violation of the independence assumption. Let's stick with that village analogy. Imagine you want to measure the impact of a new health program. You go out and survey 100 people.
Okay, your sample size, N, is 100.
But those 100 people live in just 5 different villages. So you have 20 people in each village.
Now, if I run a standard OLS, the computer just sees N100. It thinks I have 100 independent pieces of information.
But you don't, do you? People in the same village share the same water supply, the same local market, the same weather conditions. If the crops fail in Village A, everyone in Village A suffers an income shock together. Their errors are correlated within the cluster.
So adding a 21st person from Village A doesn't give me as much new information as finding a person from a totally new Village F would.
Exactly. The information is, to some extent, redundant. So if you use the default standard errors, they assume you have 100 independent units of info. They will be too small. They will be overly optimistic about your precision.
And overly optimistic means my T-stats will be inflated. I'll be more likely to find a significant result. I'll think my health program is working when it might just be some unobserved village-level coincidence.
Correct. You'll be committing a type I error. Cluster robust standard errors correct for this. They are almost always larger than the default error, sometimes much, much larger.
Mechanically, how does the math account for this? Where does the correction come from?
Well, the formula is different, but the biggest and most intuitive hit comes in the degrees of freedom.
Okay.
In a standard regression, your degrees of freedom are based on another dollar, the number of individuals, minus the number of parameters, so roughly 100. But with cluster robust inference, the degrees of freedom depend on Diddy dollars, the number of clusters.
So in our example, N is 100, but G is only 5.
Your degrees of freedom for calculating your critical T value drops from something like 99 down to G down 1 unners, which is just 4.
That is a brutal penalty.
Yeah.
Your critical T value is going to be much larger.
It is, but it's a fair penalty. It correctly reflects the true amount of independent variation you have to work with. You really only have 5 independent experiments, not 100.
So the takeaway for any listener working with data grouped by state or school or village or even by individual in a panel data set is that they absolutely must specify the cluster.
In Stata, that would be AFE-FIS-Cluster-EED, where EED is the variable that identifies your villages or schools. It is mandatory for valid inference.
Let's briefly touch on autocorrelation then, the HAC errors.
Right. HAC stands for heteroscedastic and autocorrelation robust. This is your go-to tool for time series. It assumes that the error at time 2 error, which we call 2 dollars, is related to the error at time 2D dollars and maybe $2 2, and so on.
How far back does that memory go? Do we assume the error today is related to the error 50 years ago?
Usually no. The math assumes that the correlation dies out after a certain number of periods, which we call nullers. The tricky part here is that you, the researcher, have to specify this lag length, dollars.
Is there a rule for choosing dollars, or is it just a guess?
It's not a total guess. The text provides a standard rule of thumb, which is often called the Nui West rule. It's mon dollars is approximately equal to $0.75 times T13, where $2 is the total number of time periods in your sample.
So it scales with your sample size?
No.
A longer time series allows for a longer memory in the errors.
Precisely.
Excellent. Now, I want to pivot. This is section 4 of our plan. This is a topic I feel is often glossed over in introductory courses, but chapter 12 spends a significant amount of time on it, which I appreciate. The mechanics of prediction.
Yes. This is perhaps the most practical part of the chapter for anyone who's going into industry or forecasting. We absolutely need to distinguish between two very different goals. Goal one is predicting an average outcome. The technical term is the conditional mean.
Okay.
Goal two is predicting an individual outcome or the actual value of a single observation.
But, and this is the confusing part for students, we use the exact same equation for both of them, right?
We do. The prediction equation is the same. Dsk, B1 plus B2 by 2 plus dots plus BKXK. Whether I am guessing the average price of all 2,000 square foot houses in a town or the price of this specific 2,000 square foot house you're thinking of buying, I punch the same numbers into the same calculator.
In the example from the text, for a 2,000 square foot four bedroom house, the calculation gives us a predicted value of $262,559.
Right. So the point estimate is identical, but. And this is the whole point. While the number is the same, our uncertainty around that number is radically different depending on which question we're asking.
Let's break down the precision for the average outcome first.
Okay, so we are trying to estimate AX by S. That's the expected value. The uncertainty here comes only from the fact that our estimates of the coefficients, the B dollar, B32, and so on, might be slightly off because we only have a finite sample. We don't have the whole population.
And as we get more and more data, those estimates of dollars get better and better.
Exactly. This is an asymptotic property. As the sample size $90 goes to infinity, the standard error of the conditional mean, which we can call CWYANG, goes to zero. If we had infinite data, we would know the average price perfectly. The confidence interval would collapse to a single point.
That makes perfect sense. If I average 1 million houses, all the weird random noise cancels out. But predicting the individual outcome is different.
Fundamentally different. Now, we are trying to predict YX equals beta X plus U1. Notice that $1 term at the end. That's the error term for that specific observation.
The irreducible error.
Yes, the idiosyncratic randomness of that specific house. Maybe the seller was in a hurry and took a low offer. Maybe the buyer fell in love with the wallpaper and overpaid. Maybe there was a hidden leak in the roof that nobody knew about. We cannot model that stuff.
Our best guess for that error term is zero. But we know it won't actually be zero. It's going to be something.
Exactly. So when we calculate the standard error for the forecast, denoted as SES, we have to add that uncertainty in. The formula is basically the square root of the variance of the mean plus the variance of the error term itself, 70.
So even if we had infinite data and we knew the true coefficients perfectly, that variance of the error term would still be there. The uncertainty would never go to zero.
Never. It hits a floor. The confidence interval for an individual forecast will always be wider than the confidence interval for the mean because you can never eliminate the inherent randomness of the individual unit.
Let's put some real numbers on this to show just how massive the difference is. Section 5 walks us through the house price case study prediction results.
Right. We have a specific house profile. 2,000 square feet, medium lot, 4 bedrooms, 2 baths, 40 years old. The predicted value, as we said, is roughly $257,691.
Now, let's start by assuming the standard OLS assumptions hold for a moment, just to see the difference clearly. Let's look at the confidence intervals. First, for the conditional mean, the average price of all houses with these specs, the standard error is about $6,488.
Which, when you multiply by the critical T value of about 2.07, gives us a 95% confidence interval that runs roughly from 244,235 to $271,146.
That's a range of about $27,000. Pretty tight. We have a pretty good idea of what the market price for such a house is.
I'd say so. But now let's switch questions. Let's try to forecast the price of one specific house that's about to go on the market. Now we have to add in the standard error of the regression, C dollars. In this model, C$60 is $24,936.
Wow. So that's the typical deviation of a single house price from the regression line.
Yes. And when we combine that uncertainty with the estimation error, the total standard error for the individual forecast jumps from about $6,000 to $25,766.
That's four times larger. It's massive. And the confidence interval.
The 95% interval for the individual forecast now runs from about $204,255 all the way up to $311,126.
That is a range of over $100,000.
Compare that, a $27,000 width for the average versus a $107,000 width for the individual.
It illustrates the point perfectly. Individual forecasts are just inherently noisy. You simply cannot predict the idiosyncrasies of a single transaction with the same precision as you can predict the market average.
And this brings us back to robustness. Does using robust standard errors change this prediction math much? It's a fair question.
That's a good question.
Yeah.
Does it? My intuition says it should have some effect.
Surprisingly, not really. If we assume the errors are heteroscedastic and we recalculate, the standard error for the conditional mean changes slightly. In our example, it goes from 6,488 up to 6,631, a tiny change.
Okay.
But the forecast error is so completely dominated by that massive irreducible error variance, the C$ term, that the final prediction interval is almost identical. It's barely affected.
So robustness matters a lot for testing hypotheses, for finding out if size is truly a significant predictor. But it matters a lot less for the width of your individual prediction intervals.
I think so, yes.
Because the inherent noise of the data, that U$ term, just drowns out the nuance of the standard error correction for the coefficients.
That is a very fair summary.
This leads us to a really interesting philosophical, or I guess practical question in section 6, the policy paradox. If individual forecasts are so bad, if the interval is $100,000 wide, is the model useless?
This is where economics and econometrics often get criticized. People look at models of individual behavior, like how much you're going to earn, or your labor supply decisions, or your savings behavior, and the $20 too is low. The error variance is huge.
Meaning we can't predict what you, the listener, will earn next year with any real precision.
Right. The 95% confidence interval for your personal income next year might be enormous.
Mm-hmm.
But policymakers generally don't care about you specifically. I mean, no offense.
No, I'm taking.
They care about the average. They care about the aggregate population.
The classic example is the return to education. Education and earnings.
Exactly. A regression model might have a very wide confidence interval for predicting exactly how much a specific person with a new college degree will earn. There's just too much individual variation in ability, luck, major, and so on. However, that same model can predict very precisely that, on average, a college degree increases earnings by, say, 15%.
And that average effect, which we can estimate very precisely, is what justifies the policy.
Precisely. Government subsidies for student loans or grants for education are justified by the precise average effect, despite the massive uncertainty at the individual level. We don't need to know if you will succeed. We just need to know that the average person will benefit.
That's a comforting thought for the economists out there. You don't have to be a fortune teller. You just have to understand the averages. Now, Section 7 takes us into the weeds of some advanced methodological topics. Let's hit these clearly. First up, non-representative samples.
This is a classic survey problem. Your data doesn't look like the population you want to talk about.
The text gives two scenarios here. Scenario A, you sampled non-randomly based on your independent variables. For example, your survey accidentally oversampled men compared to their share in the population.
If the sampling is based on the $6 variables, like gender or race, OLS actually handles this just fine if you include those variables as controls in the regression. You just add gender to the right-hand side and the estimates remain unbiased.
So that's an easy fix. But scenario B is trickier. Non-random sampling based on the dependent variable. Like, you want to study wealth, but your survey missed all the high earners because they wouldn't answer the phone or live in gated communities.
That is a major problem. If the selection is based on your dollar variable, OLS is inconsistent. It will give you the wrong answers. In this case, you need to use something called population-weighted least squares. You have to find external data on the true population and then weight the observations you do have to make them look like that population. It's much harder.
It's next topic. Best estimation. We all learned in our first stats class that OLS is BLEE, the best linear unbiased estimator. Is that still true in this messy world?
No. If assumptions 3 and 4 fail, if we have heterostaticity or clustered or autocorrelated errors, OLS is no longer best. It is still linear and unbiased, but it's not the most efficient. It doesn't have the smallest possible variance.
So what is the best? What beats it?
Theoretically, an approach called feasible generalized least squares, or FGLS.
That sounds complicated.
It is. It's much more involved. It requires you to explicitly model the error structure. You have to make some pretty strong assumptions about exactly how the variance changes with the X variables.
And if you guess wrong about that structure,
then your model is misspecified and your estimates can become biased. Because FGLS is complex and prone to this kind of misspecification, most economists in practice just stick with OLS and use robust standard errors.
So we're making a trade-off. We sacrifice a little bit of theoretical precision. We accept slightly larger standard errors than we might get with FGLS in exchange for simplicity and, well, robustness.
Exactly. We prefer a slightly less efficient model that we know is unbiased rather than a theoretically perfect model that might be completely wrong if we misjudge the error structure.
Let's quickly review type I versus type II errors. This is Stats 101, but give us a refresher in this context.
A type I error is a false positive. You reject the null hypothesis when you shouldn't have. You say there's an effect when, in reality, there isn't one. The probability of this is controlled by your significance level, alpha, which is usually 5%.
In type 2.
A type 2 error is a false negative. You fail to reject the null when you should have. You miss an effect that is actually there. This is related to the power of the test, the ability to detect a true effect.
And there's a trade-off. Always.
Always. If you make it super hard to get a false positive, say by lowering alpha to 1%, you automatically make it easier to get a false negative. You're going to miss more true but small effects. It is a balancing act.
Finally, let's touch on the modern era. The text makes an interesting distinction between data science and econometrics.
It does, and it's a useful one. Data science and machine learning, or ML, are primarily focused on pattern recognition and, above all, prediction. They want the best possible hatchery. They don't necessarily care about interpreting the parameters, the betas.
They don't care about the slope of the line. They just care about hitting the target.
That's a great way to put it. ML methods like random forests or neural networks are incredible at prediction. For tasks like reading a license plate or recommending a movie, they beat OLS every single time.
But there's a but.
But economists are usually interested in causality. We want to know, if I change policy X, what happens to Y? We need to isolate the causal effect of a specific variable. ML models are often black boxes. They predict incredibly well, but they don't always tell you why.
However, the text mentions a hybrid approach is emerging.
Yes, this is becoming very popular. Economists are using ML as a tool to help select control variables. If you have big data with thousands of potential controls, you can use an ML method like Lasso to intelligently pick the most important ones to avoid overfitting. And then you run your OLS regression on that smaller set of variables to do valid causal inference.
So you get the best of both worlds. And lastly, a brief mention of Bayesian methods.
This is the alternative universe to the classical or frequentist statistics we've been discussing all this time. Instead of viewing parameters as fixed unknown constants, Bayesians view parameters as having a probability distribution. You start with a prior belief, you combine it with the data, and you get a posterior distribution for your parameter.
The really cool thing here is the interpretation of the confidence interval, right?
Yes. In classical stats, we have to say these very clumsy things like, in 95% of repeated samples, the interval we construct would cover the true parameter. In Bayesian stats, you can actually say, there is a 95% probability that the true parameter lies in this interval.
Which is what everyone thinks confidence intervals mean anyway.
It's what every student wishes they meant. Bayesian methods used to be too computationally difficult for most applications, but with modern computing power, they're becoming much, much more common.
We have covered a massive amount of ground, from fixing our standard errors to the whole philosophy of prediction. Let's try to bring it all home.
If I had to summarize the journey of this chapter, it's this. We started by realizing that the perfect OLS assumptions you learn first rarely hold in the real world. But we don't throw out the model, we just fix the inference using robust standard errors, whether that's heteroscedastic, cluster, or HAC robust.
And we learned that while the coefficients themselves don't change, our confidence in them certainly does.
Then we looked at prediction. We saw this enormous gap between predicting an average, which can be done with great precision, and predicting an individual outcome, which is inherently noisy due to that irreducible error.
But that noise, that uncertainty at the individual level, doesn't invalidate the model for policy purposes, where the average effect is what matters.
Yep.
Okay, so here's my final thought for the listener. Something to chew on that isn't explicitly in the text, but builds on it. We talked about how machine learning is getting incredibly good at prediction without necessarily caring about the why.
Yes.
Does that threaten the traditional role of the economist? I mean, if a government can use an AI to predict exactly which neighborhoods need funding with 99% accuracy, do they still need an economist to build a model explaining the structural causes of poverty? Or does this just free up the economist to focus on the big what-if questions that AI, in its current form, can't answer?
That is the existential question of our field right now, I think. My suspicion is the answer is the latter, that we need the why to design the next intervention, even if the AI is great at finding the target for the current one. But it's a shifting landscape for sure.
A shifting landscape indeed. And for all the students listening, go open Stata or R, type AV robust after your next regression, and just see what happens to your t statistics. You might just find or lose a significant result.
Happy regressing.
Thanks for listening to the Deep Dive. Catch you next time.